Dan, bereft of name tag. Dan Gilman, I work at the FTC's Office of Policy Planning, and really glad to be hosting a terrific panel here this afternoon. Glad to have you all here. A couple quick things. First, as before, we have staff who can collect question cards. If you have questions, just raise the cards up or ask for a card. We'll get them on in. Some of them we might be able to read to the panel. Others we'll take back to FTC with a second. In competition with my colleague James Cooper over disclosures, I want to point out that should I happen to say something of substance here today, it does not necessarily reflect the views of the Federal Trade Commission or any individual commissioners or the Office of Policy Planning at the FTC. Any questions I ask here today do not necessarily reflect the curiosity of the Federal Trade Commission or any of its individual commissioners or any other human person. We have a very fine panel here. I'm not going to read everybody's bios. We have them available in print outside. We have them available on our website. I do want to just introduce people by name and affiliation and then leave time for them to do a brief presentation, so 6-7 minutes, and then we'll jump into our discussion. So moving from my left, Jane Bambauer, who teaches at the University of Arizona, James E. Rogers College of Law. Then Avi Goldfarb, the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management. Anja Lambrecht of the London Business School. To her left, Amalia Miller, the University of Virginia, where she's a professor in the Department of Economics. One down, I can't even see over people. Lior Strahilovitz from the University of Chicago Law School. And finally, Rahul Talang from Carnegie Mellon University. So let me just turn the floor over to Professor Bambauer.
Thank you. Thanks so much for including me. So I'm glad I'm speaking first because some of the gaps in our knowledge of how privacy and potential privacy regulation is going to affect innovation that I'm most interested in are at the sort of highest level of conceptualizing what it is that we're trying to protect when we protect privacy. And this is, I think it's important to get definitions of privacy harms right so that we can then compare them to potential trade-offs with innovation. And I thought for today's comments I would actually use the Cambridge Analytica example to illustrate that it's actually quite hard to get concrete and get agreement about what types of privacy harms we ought to have the government intervening to manage. And the reason I like using Cambridge Analytica is that almost everyone thinks something went wrong, and we all kind of use it as, we all say Cambridge Analytica, and we all nod, and we all agree, we all use it as sort of a placeholder for ick. But if we actually, if we each individually define what we think the problem is that the government needs to solve, I think we'd start rapidly splintering into different groups and could not agree on what direction to go in. So the first thing that might have gone wrong is that Facebook users didn't realize that when they were taking this little personality survey that they were exposing even their own full Facebook profile, including every like that they had ever done on Facebook, to this researcher at Cambridge, let alone the Facebook profiles of all of their friends, right? So I think descriptively that's accurate, that Facebook users did not realize how much they were waving away when they clicked, when they saw the screen warning them about the privacy implications, and they're like, yes, just get me to the survey. I need the survey. So I'm going to treat the transmission of their data as a decision that Facebook made, and I'll come back to the consent idea. But even if we think of this as being being ascribable to Facebook, I still think it's hard to define precisely what should be done. So is it that the problem is that we're letting anybody, either Facebook or third parties, study people without doing IRB-style informed consent? So inference winds up being at the heart of much of what we love about internet and smart devices and smart services. A/B testing actually involves interventions. I mean, they're randomized control experiments that for some reason the industry calls A-B testing. And so even you know, traditional interventions are a normal part of innovation. And I don't think that we want to prevent that from happening or put very cumbersome processes in the way. So then maybe what we should do is allow Facebook to study its users in that way, but not permit third parties to have access to that sort of, either the raw data itself or to the sort of hyper-customization that raw data would allow third parties to do. Well, that gets to the heart of Facebook's and Google's, for that matter, business model, right? So there's a reason that Mark Zuckerberg, in his congressional hearing testimony, rejected the idea that Facebook should shift to a pay service. I think he knows that he knows what many of the presenters at this conference have already said, that people won't actually pay for the services that they get in money, even though they will pay in data. I don't think that Congress is ready to kill Facebook. I don't think we should be ready to kill that sort of business model. And actually, this relates to the opt-out idea. On the last panel, there seemed to be at least a little bit of a consensus for, when a consumer opts out, that at least should be honored. And I'm not so sure about that. As long as opting out continues to happen at a rate of 0.24%, sure, let people opt out. It's a small cost that content providers like Facebook, can easily handle. But if John Oliver convinces a bunch of young people, millions of people, to opt out one day, then that business model is severely compromised. And so I don't think, consent itself could, at least if it's legally enforced, could wind up wiping out the payment model that we're used to. Okay, so finally, maybe then the problem is that Facebook can allow traditional advertisers to have access to this data and to use hyper-customized content, but there's something wrong with letting untraditional content providers like political actors have access to the same data or have access to targeting in the same way. And this really gets to the heart of the externality that I think many people think occurred with the Cambridge Analytica story. The line differentiating, though, like sort of standard advertising and the kind of content that we think is suspect because it might distort elections, that's awfully hard to define. And we're essentially what we would be doing is asking either Facebook or regulators to identify what counts as a bias or a manipulation versus just content, persuasive or maybe non-persuasive content that people seem to want to view based on their clicks. So this kind of raises questions that have been studied for decades now in the advertising context of created demand. Like, is there something about content providers like InfoWars that's actually creating biases and demand for certain types of content that's bad for people? Or is it that we've kind of all galvanized around blaming Facebook and Cambridge Analytica for a problem that really just kind of is at the heart of American democracy, that the only problem with democracy is its own voters, right? I'm raising a bunch of questions without offering answers right now, but I wanted to share that the way I'm starting to think about this, and I'm sort of in the early phase, but there is some evidence-based work with, is I'm starting to look for early signs of times that people may be engaged in a short-term techno panic and may be sort of psychologically and naturally geared toward resistance and hesitancy to a technology that they will, in a shorter medium amount of time, wind up adopting and even liking, versus persistent forms of privacy preferences that seem to be nearly universal and that seem to flow and be persistent even when technologies are changing. So I can say more about that during the Q&A, but I don't want to take more time.
Hi, I'm Avi Goldfarb. So a lot of these ideas that I'm going to talk about over the next 6 minutes were touched on by various people over the course of the day, but I want to maybe dig into a few of them to the extent that's possible in 6 minutes to give a high-level introduction to these ideas. So when we think about privacy, what privacy used to be was either the paparazzi. It was either there were a handful of people who were declared public figures, and they had essentially different rights than the rest of us in terms of the communication of their private life. Or we emphasized security services and the police, and you know, there were restrictions on how they could surveil the public. Privacy is now a business issue. That's why we're here. That's why it's at the FTC. Privacy is a business issue. It used to be almost purely a legal issue or a media issue. Now it's more than that. Why is it a business issue? It's a business issue because of all the data, the digitization of media and of all sorts of other aspects of life have enabled. And so what we need to recognize when we think about this as a business issue is we do know already that privacy regulation can restrict innovation, okay? There is, the empirical work so far is that there is a trade-off. That doesn't mean we can't theoretically construct a situation where privacy would enhance innovation, but the dominant empirical work so far, this is, you'll hear more of this later, but this is at least my work with Catherine Tucker, has been that privacy in the online advertising space, when you restrict information flows, well, there's a reason that those companies wanted that information. They could innovate with that information. They don't do as well without it. And that's the theme you've heard. You heard it from Garrett, and you heard a fair bit in the last panel. Another thing to recognize, so this is, you know, thinking about competition, privacy regulation can help large incumbents. Okay, so what do we mean by that? To the extent that there's a... it happens in two different ways. So one way is you might be much more likely to trust Google than some new startup that you've never heard of. And so you might be more likely to give an old, established large company, large brand, data about yourself than a startup. That's, in addition to that, what this particular paper is about is another idea, which is that if you touch a company in lots of different places, or in particular a company touches you in a lot of different places, that means that one opt-out can help that company in lots of different ways. And so if you're a startup or a smaller company that really is only doing one particular product, they have to pay effectively the same regulatory cost to get you to consent as a very large company. And that can create an opportunity and essentially benefit incumbents relative to entrants, benefit large companies at the expense of small. So if privacy... if the sort of empirical and theoretical structures that we have suggest privacy is going to hurt innovation and it might hurt competition, well, why are we talking about this at all? And the reason is that consumers actually do care about privacy. So this was a debate we've heard. Yes, consumers aren't opting out of these things, but when we fix a particular context, we see more privacy protective behavior today than we used to. So it's much harder to get people to fill out surveys than it used to be. The census has to work harder to get people to fill out the census or, you know, information. It, given a context for communicating data, or when we fix that, we're even more privacy sensitive than we used to be. What's changed, and the reason why we had the discussion, or at least I think the reason why we had that discussion in the previous panel on, yeah, but consumers don't seem to be doing anything about it, is because along with more privacy concern has come with huge benefits to data sharing. And so, you know, even if the costs are increasing or the perceived costs of sharing data are increasing, the perceived benefits, the ability to have Facebook and Google, et cetera, has grown as well. And so the point is there's a trade-off between privacy and innovation. In lots of cases, there's a trade-off between privacy and competition. But that doesn't mean that privacy is bad. It just means that we need to recognize a these as distinct values, and we need to think about weighing them against each other. So the policy issue, so the theoretical policy issue is essentially privacy regulation can't be too strict Because if it's strict, it'll stifle data-driven innovation and competition, right? If you don't allow firms to use data, they can't use data. And if data enables competition, as we heard earlier today, or as I just described, or if data enables innovation, it's maybe the core input into a lot of the most exciting technologies today, artificial intelligence, ad exchanges, et cetera, then privacy regulation would be too strict. Strict privacy regulation would hurt innovation, hurt competition. That said, we got to remember, privacy regulation can't be too lax either. If it's so lax that consumers don't trust companies, then the companies won't get the data either. In Europe and the United States, at least the empirical evidence so far is we're a long way away from that. It's not clear if we are worldwide. So getting the balance right is the key challenge here. And given the importance of data to innovation, and AI in particular, privacy policy is one important way the regulatory environment is going to affect the rate and direction of innovation and the degree to which competition plays out. With that, Anya.
Thank you. So I'm going to build directly on what Avi just said and start with a particular setting, which is financial services. And so you can well imagine that in financial services, personal finance, consumers, we all worry a lot about privacy and security. That is a particular setting I studied together with my co-author at the time, quite new technological service, which in the early 2000s was online banking. And the question is, how do you actually, once you start sharing information with consumers, protect consumers' privacy and security? Now, nowadays, online banking is something we're used to on an everyday basis. In the early 2000s, was not very much spread, but I think there are lessons that we can learn for the use of new technologies in today and in the future. What is the underlying trade-off? Well, of course, especially in this type of setting, consumers care about privacy and security verification hurdles to prevent others, third parties, to access their financial information and potentially execute transactions such as money transfers in these consumers' names. But the other point is that consumers, and Avi briefly alluded to that, also care very much about ease of use, or else they may not adopt the new technological service, right? And so this is ultimately the trade-off we worry about a lot when we speak about privacy and technology adoption. And the question is, what are actually the implications? Now, in that particular study, in that particular empirical setting, what we observe is that because of privacy and security concerns, the bank implemented multiple hurdles for a consumer to use the service, starting with a requiring a paper-based sign-up, then sending to the consumer login information that allows the consumer to use the service in terms of gathering information, but not actually executing transaction. To do the latter, an additional piece of information, transaction numbers, were required. And so what we have ultimately in this type of setting and more generally is a multi-stage adoption process where the consumer goes through the hurdles of signing up, logging in, doing a transaction, and potentially substantive over time repeat usage. Given these hurdles that were implemented in order to protect consumer privacy and security, what we have here is that actually since the consumer had to go through all these steps, this introduced substantial delays in the process. Right? And what we find is that delays that come here through this process through exogenous shifters actually reduces at any point in time the probability a consumer would go to the next stage, say from logging in, actually doing a first transaction. And these effects are significant. So, for example, more than a third of consumers would not log in the month of sign-up. About a third of consumers would not actually initiate a transaction in the month of their first login. And so you can see what the knock-on effect of those are, both for consumers who now do not use a service that is intended to you know, make their life easier, perhaps, or have a be more efficient in actually handling and transferring in their money, keeping a certain balance in their banking accounts. And on the other hand, for firms who still needed to deal a lot more with paper-based transactions. And so to wrap this short summary up, the key insight here is that, well, complex security protocols that we might want to set up to ensure privacy and security of very personal, important pieces of information might, on the other hand, actually reduce adoption. And to the extent that we think that adoption of new technologies and innovations are good for consumers and maybe for the economy more broadly, that raises the question about where the balance would be and what could be done to eliminate these frustrations by consumers while at the same point in time encouraging adoptions. And so the key point, therefore, is whether efforts that we have to ensure online data security and the privacy can therefore have and how they can have unintended consequences for the diffusion of new innovative services. And I think any discussion of these questions will need to consider such unintended consequences. Thank you.
Great. So what I'd like to do with these remarks is to talk a little bit about some empirical research that I've done focusing on the area of health privacy and looking at the effects of different privacy regulation related to healthcare data. And I focus on health in my research, health privacy in particular, because health is an area where we have sensitive information. The privacy issues can be really important. The data can be persistent. And also it's the area where in the United States there's been the most regulatory activity on the part of states. So the first paper I want to talk about looked at the effect of regulation that was targeting one aspect of data privacy, which is data security. It's about controlling information and making sure it's not being used in ways that are not intended. And specifically what we did was we looked at what happens when states pass laws that were encouraging data security practices, and they were trying to encourage firms to adopt encryption technology and encrypt their data. What we found is that when states had these encryption exemptions in their data privacy rules that basically promoted encryption, we find that more hospitals adopted encryption. And data loss went up. Why is that? Human error. So what happened was the policy was pushing a technology. Firms responded by adopting the technology, but it didn't achieve the policy goal. And I think that the theme there that I want to kind of draw out from this research that I'll come to again is that when we think about designing our policies, we want to think about the goal and we want to think about the details of how we get there. And so focusing on a particular technology, especially in a sphere where technology is evolving, can often lead to weaker effects than we expect or even reverse or perverse effects. That theme is going to come up in the second paper I want to tell you about, which was a paper that looked at some policy efforts that were made to encourage the adoption of health IT as part of the High Tech Act. And specifically, one of the goals was to try to encourage hospitals to exchange health information about patients. The policy lever that was applied in trying to achieve this goal was promoting a technological capacity on the part of hospitals. So they had to show that they had the technology to be able to share data and to exchange data, and that it could be interoperable with other systems. What we find in our research is that the focus on technology, again, was not sufficient. We find in our research that hospitals that were part of big hospital systems with lots of hospitals in them were actually more likely to exchange data with other hospitals. They were more likely to have the capacity to exchange data. But they exchanged data internally with other hospitals in their system. What they didn't do, or what they were much less likely to do, was to share data outside of their system. Okay, and so the reason for that is that they didn't necessarily have a business incentive to want to share the data. Right, the hospital is producing this information. They are creating medical records. They're collecting information. They're storing it. And they are not necessarily going to want to give it away freely to their competitors, to other hospitals in their local area. even if there is a policy benefit or a public benefit for that. And so what we have is this creation of information silos. By focusing on technology, we didn't prevent that. So this echoes, again, the first theme about thinking about how we design our specific interventions and how that's important. The second theme, I think, is even broader, which is it relates to this question of how do we think about data, health data about individuals, but actually consumer data or individual data more broadly. Okay, and this question about ownership, I think, is a little bit new and special here. The fact is that companies or businesses or organizations are creating data. They're collecting data. It's their data. They might think they own it, but it's data about people. And so people might think that they have some ownership. And it's actually ambiguous who should own the data and even who does own the data. And I think this ambiguity about property rights and about even what there should be is an area of concern and an area that leads, I think, to some potential inefficiencies. It also means that when we think about privacy policy, there's not a clear binary on-off of do we protect privacy or not, or how much do we protect along a single linear dimension, but there's questions about what aspect of privacy are we targeting. Are we talking about the ability to collect it, to store it, to exchange it, or to use it? Are we talking about users' rights to access their own information? So the third paper that I want to tell you about, this third research paper also in healthcare, looks at variation in policies, in privacy policies that actually took different approaches, all to address the same common issue of genetic privacy. So different states took different approaches to protecting genetic information, and what we look at in our research is how these different approaches affect the rates at which individuals were willing to get genetic tests to predict their cancer risk. So this can be very sensitive information. You think privacy protection could be important. What we find here is that the type of the protection actually makes a big difference, and that the different forms of protection had completely different effects. So a policy approach that focused on informed consent and letting individuals know about exactly who had the property rights and how that information was going to be used and about their privacy concerns actually had a significant effect of lowering rates of testing. When the privacy laws instead emphasized required permission from consumers for their own data to be redisclosed or sent to a third party, so gave the individual more ownership, that actually promoted adoption. A third approach, it's actually the most common approach used in privacy protection for genetic information, is a focus on how the data can be used. And so rules like that limit the ability of employers or insurers to use genetic information in terms of pricing or market interactions actually had no effect on adoption. So these anti-discrimination laws that focus on the use of data were not effective. There are various reasons for these effects, and maybe we'll have time to talk about more in the Q&A. But I'm running out of time, so I want to say this, again, I think, highlights this theme earlier about the details of the policy making a big difference, and even policies that almost sound like they're the same thing, a genetic privacy law, can actually have opposite effects depending on the particulars of how it's specified. Okay, so to summarize, I want to just relate this to the two topics of the panel. First of all, as we relate to competition policy, I think the research we found with the creation of data silos in big hospital systems emphasizes the important concerns that we should have about big data and the potential to lock in consumers, and how this does create potentially a competitive advantage for bigger firms and make it harder for entrants and small firms to compete, and it relates to the exchange of information. Second point is that when we think about innovation policy, all of these papers that I've talked about and some that I haven't had a chance to talk about but that Avi and Anya have talked about, I think all show that there is a real connection between privacy regulation and future innovation, and in many ways privacy policy is innovation policy in healthcare and elsewhere.
Thank you.
Great. Hi. Thanks. I titled this "Confessions of a Convert," and I'll explain that. Which is that I've been writing about privacy for 16 years, and often find myself at conferences of privacy law scholars, all of who favor much more aggressive privacy regulation, and I've been one of the few people to say, oh, let's apply the brakes. Let's think about the trade-offs involved. So I'll talk you through about a decade's worth of research and how I got to where I am now. So exactly a decade ago, I started thinking about ways in which the proliferation of reputation information about individuals was providing all kinds of opportunities for law and legal systems. Yelp and regulation of the medical profession by the AMA are substitutes for one another. And in a lot of respects, the kinds of information that's generated by services like Yelp or TripAdvisor provides a really nice substitute for government inspectors and those sorts of mechanisms of making sure that consumers are getting their money's worth and that firms are behaving appropriately. About a half decade ago, I started thinking about the political economy of privacy, why differences arise, especially between the United States and Europe, which have only become more pronounced since then, and tried to emphasize that privacy regulations create winners and losers, and that we can predict who they'll be, that sometimes the impacts of privacy regulations are often regressive. And then just a couple of years ago, I started to think empirically about research. This is actually a 2016 paper rather than a 2014 one. But in any event, what we tried to do was make some progress on one of the chief topics for this panel today, which is to figure out, well, why aren't markets developing? We spent a lot of time looking at the use of automated content analysis of consumers' emails for the purposes of serving them with personalized advertisements. We asked consumers, a nationally representative sample of them, how invasive do you regard these sorts of practices where Gmail is looking at the contents of your emails and giving you personalized ads? And they said quite invasive. 7.63 was the mean response on a scale of 1 to 10. And at the same time, we said, well, would you be willing to pay any amount of money to avoid it? No, was the response of about two-thirds of the sample. And that's another example of the privacy paradox that's been mentioned in some of the other research. Among those who were willing to pay, the median willingness to pay stated in surveys, so not a revealed preference, was just $15 per year, and looking at how much consumers said this data was worth to them versus how much we know it's worth to Google or Facebook or Yahoo, we think that probably those platforms value it more than the individual consumers do, at least with respect to personalized ads based on email content. So that's sort of what I've been working on and how I arrived here today, and I do want to stick by some earlier views that I've articulated, which is that there's still lots of reason to think that the U.S. has done quite well by having a relatively permissive environment, that we've seen a lot of innovation, that there are technologies that have developed in the United States that couldn't have developed in Europe because people would have needed permission to do the, to develop the kinds of applications that have proved to be so successful both here and there. But at the same time, there seem to be real breakdowns in the self-regulatory model in the laissez-faire approach. One of these breakdowns is that consumers often don't know about all the problems that can arise, whether it's on a data security side or on a privacy side. With robust journalistic efforts, with robust enforcement by the FTC, consumers can find out and make informed decisions. It's not clear that adequate resources are being developed to identify privacy snafus or data security snafus by either of those institutions. And the proof is in the pudding to some extent, which is to say that if you ask Americans, as Reuters did a few months ago, whether they trust Facebook to obey the laws that protect their personal info, the majority will say, no, we don't trust Facebook, even though Facebook has a very, very strong financial incentive in getting people to yes on that question. And some of the other technology companies with probably better records generate majorities saying that we trust you, but not anywhere near supermajorities. Okay, so as we think about privacy from where we are in 2018, I think we can talk about some of the fundamental ways in which the world's looking worse for privacy and the laissez-faire approach than it was 10 years ago. Jane talked about Cambridge Analytica. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about that during the Q&A. I probably think there are things we can all agree about that Cambridge Analytica did wrong. Most prominently, I should have the right to reveal or not reveal personal information about myself, and I didn't choose to delegate that to the 800 friends I have on Facebook. And when Facebook organized their APIs such that any of 800 people could choose to reveal a lot of information about me that was potentially sensitive, that strikes me as a technological breakdown, one that potentially lends itself to regulation. We're seeing, especially in the last election cycle, in the last couple of years, doxing, instances of online harassment, online trolling, that's really off the charts. And I think it's scaring off the sensible center from a lot of political discourse, scaring off women, scaring off people of color, really compromising fundamental values that are bedrocks of American and democratic societies. More generally, think about how often you answer your cell phone now versus how often, if it's an unrecognized number, you just let it ring and go to voicemail. Lots and lots of people, as a result of breakdowns in Do Not Call and flagrant violations of Do Not Call, lots of people have stopped answering phones. And think about the costs of that. Those costs are real, and they're felt by consumers. They're felt by people trying to make phone calls. And we can look overseas and see some of the things that's happening with social credit scoring in China and be really worried about some of the potential for abuses of these kinds of technologies. So just in the minute I've got left, let me identify a couple of issues. The first, which I think we'll talk about on the next panel, is there's lots of inconsistencies between GDPR and the American approach. The world is going with the European approach, not with the American approach. That makes that causes real problems for American companies and for the free flow of data across the Atlantic, across the Pacific, between North America and Latin America. So one idea that harkens back to work by Victor Mayer Schoenberg, Schoenberger in his 2009 book Delete, which formed the basis for the European right to be forgotten, turns out, I think, to have some modern adaptations, which is here's a proposal for deletion by default. Okay, the main problem with the right to be forgotten as currently implemented by the European Union is that it's unconstitutional under First Amendment law. There are ways to accomplish the same kinds of objectives without running aground of any constitutional problems. And deletion by default, which is certain data, should automatically be deleted by, let's say, 10 years after it's collected, purchase history information, Facebook posts, etc. And people could always choose to opt out of that, which is, I think, both constitutionally permissible under the U.S. regime and also probably better. So Google puts out really useful data about how often people are actually exercising the right to be forgotten. And it turns out that the rate of utilization is about 0.15% of European residents have exercised their rights under the right to be forgotten under a generous interpretation of data from the Google Transparency Report. So as we think about, well, what are the kinds of purposes that are vindicated by the right to be forgotten? The right to be forgotten as employed, which puts the onus on the consumer to delete information, isn't working. Something like deletion by default would work much better, and it's an approach worth considering. Thanks.
Mr. Talang, who is not Lee Strahilovitz,
no.
But sorry.
I'll try to be quick so that we have opportunities for others to chime in as well. My name is Rahul Talang. I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. I'll pick up from where Lior left. I'm not as pessimistic, I think, as maybe he is about the power of markets and competition in solving some of the problems. But let me just highlight and maybe we all agree with this. But in an ideal world, really, what we want to know is where exactly is the friction, rather than thinking about what regulations will work. We want to probably sit back and ask, what exactly is the friction that people face when they're dealing with the customer data or our own data, and firms are utilizing that information? You know, think of that as essentially an externality problem, that firm has my data, they are somehow misusing it or extracting too much rents out of it than I would like them to do it, and that's the externality they're imposing on me. And the question is that how can we push that externality back onto the firms? Maybe I'm misquoting, but generally the FTC has looked at this as a problem of, can we make information available to consumers so they can make better informed decisions, more or less without imposing too much of regulation? And I think that's what Lior also sort of mentioned. And I'll come back and talk a little bit about where we stand. But then the idea is that, well, this should lead to, you know, across-the-board innovation, both at the demand side and actually at the supply side, right? I mean, if you want a whole lot of privacy, then there should be some firms available who are willing to provide that privacy. Maybe not at the firm level, but maybe at the intermediary level. Maybe you will use, you know, certain browser with certain features in it that will make sure that Facebook might or might not be able to collect your data. Maybe you're not able to do it, but at some level, the idea is that both that there is going to be a demand for privacy, security, whatever you want to name it, but then also there is a potential possibility of supply for privacy or security. And, you know, I guess the question, maybe some of us believe that this model can never work. Maybe some of us might believe that at least partially this model can work. I mean, fundamentally, this problem maybe just come down to whether security and privacy can be a feature that the firm can advertise. And it doesn't have to be that whether we are willing to pay for it monetarily. There are some other ways people are willing to pay, including market share, transactions, how long we want to have relationship with the firm, so on and so forth, or whether it is just a bug that we are worried about, and then everybody is trying to figure out a way to undermine that. In some aspect, the evidence is not completely negative. I mean, in fact, if you think about it, you know, maybe the data breach notification law would be a good example where, you know, it forced a fair amount of disclosure, at least on the parts of the firm. And if you look at it, we are holding a lot of firms actually accountable. Even if not the firms directly, we do punish the executives. I mean, Equifax CEO had to resign because there was a data breach. Mark Zuckerberg did have to come in front of the Congress and actually provide some details and, you know, at least some embarrassment. Wall Street Journal reporting and New York Times Press, which probably none of them they would like. So there is a little bit of externality that we are pushing back on the firm without any, you know, serious regulation on what you can do with my data or what you cannot do with the data, but at least in terms of making it clear to people that, look, these people might or might not be abusing our data. And there is really no impact, no way for us to empirically measure whether things have gotten worse or better, but there is at least some evidence that maybe firms are being elastic to some of those changes in terms of how they are storing our data, how they are sharing our data, so on and so forth. I think, you know, one other point is that sometimes we talk about, you know, when we're designing policy, can you share the data? Should we stop the data sharing between firms or data abuse? I think at some level you could also think of maybe there is certain part of the data that is off limits, and maybe there is some other part of the data it's perfectly might satisfy the firm. So, I mean, think about online advertisement. Sure, some targeting is very effective. We need some data for that targeting to be very effective, but maybe there is a whole lot of information that the firm uses is really not that effective. Or they can find proxy for that and be able to be reasonably effective without knowing my social security number or name or what have you, and some other proxies might work too. So it doesn't have to be always a zero-sum game. One more point and how does, okay. One more point I wanted to highlight is that it's also, we have to remember sometimes that sometimes is the uncertainty in regulation that actually can hurt innovation more than the regulation itself sometimes. Again, if you go back, when the data breach notification laws came, everybody complained about it. So much compliance is happening. So much compliance costs are happening. I don't think anybody complains about it. In fact, firm says, you know, instead of 50 different states, I would rather have one national law so that, you know, I can kind of get over with or lower my compliance costs. Nobody's saying that we shouldn't be having those laws. And in fact, if you think about it, there are second order and third order benefits to sometimes these regulations. For example, if you talk to cyber insurance policymakers, they will everybody would agree that actually the data breach notification laws led to so much cyber policy being written to provide insurance against data breaches, because some of those regulations actually provided some certainty about what the cost would be, what the floor would be, what the ceiling would be, and that led to, you know, some of the significant growth in cyber insurance, which also then creates good practices and what have you. So there are all these secondary and tertiary benefits sometimes with regulations. Lack of uncertainty can help. There's a lot of work, not just in the privacy space, but automobile space, health space, environment protection space, which seems to argue that if you reduce some uncertainty and stop sending unclear signals to the industry, actually it can be very helpful. Again, go back. Automobile industry bitterly opposed the seat belt and the airbag. And once those regulations actually came in, they figured out a way to actually live with that, not only live with that, actually innovate where all of us benefited, the consumers as a safety, but they also were able to sell it as a feature where they were able to actually price them out. So something to think about where we think about regulation, that sometimes having some certainty can be actually much more useful than sometimes just arguing about what the regulation and the content of the regulation should be. Stop here.
Okay, terrific. I'd like to start really with a question for the entire panel. We've had, and I'm sort of reminded, we've had some really excellent research-based panels. We are a research-based agency. We do research-based law enforcement on both the competition and the consumer protection side. We do research-based policy work, but I'm thinking of various threads that have come up over the 2 days that have reminded me of an outdated and terribly unfair label for economics as the dismal science. So what do I have in mind here? There's quite a bit of research on certainly market imperfections, whether or not they're durable market failures, people might debate. So very high information costs, very high maybe information asymmetries when it comes to privacy issues, both between firms and end consumers, folks like we're sitting up here, and indeed between firms as vendors and firms as consumers. Certainly there's evidence of people suffering this kinds of information privacy-related harms, ranging from identity theft to any manner of other things. We've had some very interesting and I think useful and important research on some of the limits of intervention in this space, right? So first, competition issues surrounding privacy interventions, which may not always, but may tend to favor large firms and incumbent firms at the expense of smaller firms or entrants. Certainly unanticipated effects from privacy regulations, which sometimes just I'm thinking of some of Professor Miller's research, say with Catherine Tucker, just health effects that weren't anticipated with HIT regulations, one thing, or even, you know, you flip the sign of your anticipated effect is with some of the data security regulations. It doesn't mean that all data security regulations will have these effects, but it's certainly not a positive result. And so I guess one thing is sort of just a question go down the line. It seems that there is maybe some pertinent research, but quite a bit less that answers the policy question, what do consumers win with one or another privacy or data regulation intervention? Plainly, consumers have concerns in this space. I don't think anybody would deny that, but one question is, do we have an adequate research basis for saying, first of all, that these interventions will actually be effective, whether in one silo or another or across large sectors of the economy? And second, you know, an adequate way of assessing consumer benefits, right? So we have costs when we fail to intervene. We have costs when we intervene. Have we developed a good science of assessing and then actually achieving concrete benefits. Anyone? Yeah, we'll go down this way unless someone wants to pass.
So I agree that we have very good research on some narrow questions. I continue though I'm basically restating what my opening comments were, that I continue to be concerned that we haven't even really defined the harms in order well enough to then know how to measure them, and that's really a sort of more of a philosophical question than even an empirical one. And so if without it, though, the foundation for doing the empirical research that we would need to do is lacking. I'm concerned that we don't have enough of an evidence base quite yet.
So if we weren't the dismal, we're looking for some kind of Pareto optimal solution where everyone, there's a market failure where everyone would be better off because we have a regulation. It doesn't happen that often. Maybe credit scoring and the Fair Credit Reporting Act was a privacy regulation that was Pareto improving, but in some sense we've been looking for that in the privacy space for 20 years. It's not obvious that such a thing happens. It seems pretty clear that the empirical work says there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off between, more privacy might mean less innovation, it might mean less competition. I have some other work that suggests it might mean more inequality. But that doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. We've also heard a whole bunch of reasons why privacy is good. And so, it's this regulation is not effective. In some sense, a lot of the regulations have been extraordinarily effective. If the goal was to restrict data flows, the regulations restrict data flows. They do exactly what they were supposed to do. That just means that ads become less effective or healthcare doesn't work as well. But they are effective in terms of their explicit goals on restricting data flows. So I just think it's important to realize there's trade-offs here. These are hard decisions. And in some sense, the empirical work, like as an economist, I don't feel like I have the skills to tell you about those trade-offs. What I can say is what those, I can really lay out well is what those trade-offs are.
Okay, so 2 points on that. I think one interesting point is that the perception of privacy changes. What we regard today as privacy relevant or what was regarded 20 or 50 years ago as privacy relevant or sensitive information may not be regarded as such anymore today, at least not all of it. And if I look at my younger students, they might still have a different perception of which data are, privacy sensitive than I have. So I think one aspect is that the sensitivities and therefore the trade-offs also change over time. And I think this is just one point to keep in the back of our mind as we are trying to think about policies. Mm-hmm. The second point is that I do believe that these trade-offs are highly context-dependent, and the harms and the benefits are very context-dependent. And similar to what Avi said, I think it's very hard to lay out the overarching framework for how these trade-offs should be solved. So think, for example, a retailer that holds information about your browsing behavior. We had the example of Target earlier, but think about this happening online, and uses it in a way that one consumer feels is privacy invading. On the other hand, the retailer might also use that information to structure information displayed in response to product searches on their website, which may have for consequence that the consumer gets a better selection of product, a better choice, makes a better choice, and spends less time on making those choices. And so this is what I mean with context-dependent. There are settings where the harms may more obviously, the benefits may more obviously outweigh the harms, and maybe other settings where the harms may play out in very different ways, way outside the specific context, as, for example, in online advertising.
Okay, so I think these are the tough questions. A few thoughts. One thing in thinking about the costs and benefits of privacy protection, I think it's always helpful for me to step back and think about the costs and benefits of privacy itself and then think about the privacy regulation. I think that you know, some of the results that I found that we find of privacy regulation leading to less adoption of technology could actually reflect an underlying latent benefit or need for that regulation. So to the extent that informing consumers about privacy risks makes them less likely to do something that entails a privacy risk, it's not obvious that that's inefficient. It could be that they were inefficiently unaware of privacy risks or that it wasn't salient to them. And so I think that there's sort of a question of, how much are we so there's a question, there's trade-offs involved in the privacy policy, and I think also the point Avi made earlier is important, that no privacy protection is also going to be a problem. So when we think about the costs and benefits of privacy protection policy, one of the big costs we want to think about from not protecting privacy is all of the privacy-protecting activities that individuals will engage in the absence of regulation that protects them. So if they don't feel that their data are safe, they may not download apps on their phone. They may not do different kinds of things. They may, shut off Facebook or never post pictures of their child online because they don't feel that that privacy is protected. And so we think about those potential benefits from privacy protection. We want to take those into account. At the same time, my own research and other research by others does show that sometimes regulation, well-intended, can have real harms in terms of slowing the diffusion of technologies. I didn't talk about this paper, but this other research I did with Catherine Tucker looked at privacy laws. Protecting health privacy led to less adoption of electronic medical records in U.S. hospitals. And then we show in another paper that this actually this slower adoption led to greater mortality, greater infant mortality, because this technology itself was saving infants' lives. And so there are, real substantial costs to not protecting privacy, but also to not having these technological innovations in healthcare and other spheres. I just kind of want to give some another point about just the very pessimistic results that I have about, I think the trade-offs are real, and I think they're important to consider, but I don't want the message to be, I think the message should be that we should be cautious and the details matter, and there are a lot of ways we can go wrong. But I don't want the message to be that's an excuse for inaction or for just throwing our hands up and not trying. I think what it means is that we should have modest expectations. We should put in some effort before we make rules and to try to look at the research, try to experiment, try things on a smaller scale, maybe where the impact is not going to be so bad if we get it wrong, and try things. And then, be flexible. If we have a policy, let's monitor and let's see if it's working or if it's not working. And if it isn't, let's change it. So I don't think that it's something that we sit down and, in a room devise the optimal solution, QED X star, and we just go with that. I think we just want to be aware of the issues and then actively, continuously try to work on that.
I think I agree with what's been said. It's hard to do cost-benefit analysis for privacy because privacy harms are and always have been hard to quantify. Okay, so let's start with that. But that doesn't mean that when we're trying to do something like cost-benefit analysis, we have to throw our hands up in the air. So one thing that you can try and do is look around you and think about whether the ways in which the legal system deals with privacy are typical or exceptional. And so I want to provide two lenses from doing that. One way you can do that is by looking at how privacy gets treated versus how other kinds of big goofs get treated. All right. So one thing that's really unusual about the way that privacy is regulated by the Federal Trade Commission is that the Federal Trade Commission does not start out with fining authority for big privacy goofs. And so when I explained to lay people that it's only because Facebook had previously entered into a consent decree with the FTC that the FTC has the ability to impose monetary fines as a result of Cambridge Analytica, they're very surprised by that. You're probably not surprised by that, but people you talk to who are not lawyers, regulators, policy people are probably extremely surprised. And indeed, that makes the United States exceptional when compared to the way that other companies deal with privacy, other countries deal with privacy, and also other parts of the U.S. Regulatory system deal with big goofs, right? So when Ford Pintos started exploding, right, because of faulty gas tanks, we didn't say, okay, Ford, you know, if you make another car that starts exploding, we will fine you for that. But, you know, you get one free goof. This was a badly designed car. You're off the hook. Right? We kind of have that response with respect to privacy, at least from a federal regulatory perspective. There's other things that will happen, like class action lawsuits that Facebook will be dealing with. They'll lose some consumers. I'm not suggesting that they face no repercussions. But it is a little bit unusual that how we treat privacy vis-a-vis other kinds of products and how we treat, or other kinds of interests, and how the U.S. treats privacy versus the way the rest of the developed world treats privacy. And I think that can be informative in terms of how we should think about what the right approach is.
Is there a generic takeaway? It's really hard to say anything simply because... is there a generic takeaway that we can take, from all the research and a meta research? It's hard because it's a very heterogeneous problem. I think one thing that I feel we can take away is that, you know, consumers are really good at compartmentalizing. That they for us, the transaction costs are very high. Even reading one line every time we transact with a website is just too costly for us. However, there's some research that I'm working on, and one of the challenge of privacy research at some level is that if you go survey based, then you're always overestimating everything, because if you ask people, then I think people have already in the last panel talked about the variance between survey and behavior is so large that you wonder what you can glean. Plus, there is a long-term issue too. But anyway, we are actually working with the actual transaction. We are working with a very large bank, which has very detailed information on how people transact. And one other thing that we clearly notice, that people care if something goes wrong with their financial, if something goes wrong with the credit card, with their bank, with something that has direct money involved, they are a lot more careful. They are a lot more willing to punish the firm if it's going to have if a fraud is going to happen on your bank or your credit card account, and we can see that in the data. On the other hand, if Home Depot loses your data, or if Target loses your data, we are a lot less willing to punish them. Our transaction behavior doesn't change a whole lot, maybe because we think that, well, Lowe's isn't going to be any better. Maybe we think that the financial cost is really not very high. The credit card is going to pick it up. I'll get a new credit card. I really don't want to kind of go through all the hassle. So I feel like it's very context dependent. If I feel that I'm going to incur a significant financial harm, I think people really take action. And if they feel that, well, the financial harm is secondary, tertiary, might happen sometimes in the future, might not happen at all, I think they tend to kind of ignore many of the, you know, the privacy red lights, if you would, in that regard.
Sorry, just wanted to add one thing. I think it might be useful to distinguish the intrinsic value of privacy that people might want control over the access to their data and the ultimate use of their data from the downstream harms that privacy might protect. And I find that if we identify the downstream harms, then we can try to measure them. That gives us a lot better of a chance, I think, to do this trade-off. But with the intrinsic value of privacy, I don't quite know what a privacy goof, for example, is. I know that when a Pinto explodes, nobody wants to be in that Pinto, but everyone basically ascribes roughly the same value to their health and life and also their money, but the intrinsic value of privacy is not clear to me. And I think Ginger Jin mentioned yesterday that a problem in this area is that preferences, to the extent they can be measured at all, are widely varying. They're time dependent. They're dependent on so many things that I don't even know if it's useful to think about intrinsic values, and maybe we should just be looking at the downstream.
So, thank you. I'm interested in the conditions under which someone does want to be in a Pinto. We've heard a lot, I think, here about context, and maybe it's not surprising that people have done very fruitful research in specific context, specific industries, specific technologies, right? Whether we're talking about finance, consumer credit, healthcare, different research on healthcare systems adoption versus other issues in healthcare. I mean, maybe in some ways, to pick up on something that was mentioned about FTC. This is convenient for the FTC's approach to privacy, both on the competition side and the consumer protection side, right? We look at transactions, at mergers that may unduly burden competition and do harm to consumers. We have a framework for doing that, whether in the information economy or elsewhere, on the consumer protection side with privacy and data security enforcement. We look for harms, right, specific harms cognizable under the FTC Act or under special statutes, and evidence for concrete harms in concrete contexts, and under unfairness, harms that aren't offset, say, by countervailing efficiencies. But I'm also wondering a little bit first, was mentioned, I think, by Professor Strahilovitz, can't see on there, maybe I've just got it wrong, about our authority, well, maybe two of you, conditions under which we can levy fines or pursue different remedies. So one question I would ask is simply, what adjustments might be recommended to our authority or not to improve our ability to address context-specific harms, whether on the competition side or on the consumer protection side. And then I guess second, sort of the what's left out, we don't do everything. Are we optimistic or pessimistic about extending some of this learning to calls for much more general overarching privacy regulation, whether we're talking about, you know, so compare and contrast, say, HIPAA with the GDPR approach or you know, Fair Credit Reporting Act with the GDPR approach, federal, state, industry, or overarching. I guess both, so two hard questions, if we could just go down the panel, and I guess I think we've actually got 8 minutes, but thank you. By the clock, we're scheduled to go to 4. No? That's what it says here. Okay. Sorry, if we could go briefly.
What was the question again?
Okay, so I'll summarize. So
FTC authority is one. Would you alter it based on any findings? Maybe that's enough.
I'll take a stab at it. So I think one thing that would be really useful for the FTC to think about are what are the kinds of problems that the courts have a hard time remedying. And so, you know, a classic example is the data breach, okay? So courts really struggle with data breaches for the following reason. Let's suppose a whole bunch of data is breached. Let's suppose that every American faces a baseline risk every year of 2% chance they'll be victimized by identity theft, okay? Now let's suppose that the people whose data was breached face a 3% chance of identity theft, okay? And let's say we're talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. We know that the breach was costly, very costly. We know that it elevated the risk for people in the pool, relevant pool, by 50%. But courts are going to be looking for proof that a particular individual suffered identity theft, the classic harm in a data breach, as a result of this particular breach. Okay? You'll want to, at least there's a circuit split in terms of dealing with these issues, but you'll want, in order to have an airtight ability to get first standing and then establish the causal nexus, you're going to need to show a court that it's more probable than not that particular individuals suffered particular out-of-pocket harms, pecuniary harms, as a result of a breach. And I think courts have a hard time with those kinds of cases. That's not the standard model of how a court proceeds. The standard model of how a court proceeds is show me in a civil suit that it's more probable than not that your injury resulted from their mistake. Okay? So that's an area where we know statistically a lot of people are harmed, but we also know courts, Article III courts, are going to really struggle with it, where I think there's a lot of room for the FTC to do really good work, because the FTC can litigate on and enforce on behalf of the aggregate. And it doesn't so much matter whether any individual happens to have been victimized because of the baseline risk of identity theft or because of the elevated risk resulting from a particular breach. And so I think that when the FTC thinks about its authority, it should think about, okay, what are class action lawyers doing, and is any of that accomplishing any good? What is self-regulation doing, and is any of that accomplishing any good? What are state attorneys general doing, and is any of that accomplishing any good? Okay, what are the things that they're bad at? Odds are good that those are the things that the FTC can add the most value through.
Thank you. Apparently, we're also bad at time management. so I apologize for cutting this short. Thanks very much to our panelists for their contributions, and thanks for your attention. We've